Thanks for inviting me here. And I must say, I was when Paul invited me to give the physics colloquium, I puzzled about what I should talk about. And I thought, should I talk about my latest research? And then fortunately, I had a chance to do that on Monday. So I thought in today's seminar, I'd be just a little bit more expansive. You don't often get a captive audience of physicists. And physicists are kind of the hardest audience to talk to, apart from school children, I think. You know, you're kind of smart but ignorant, if I may say so. Okay. Absolutely. I'm going to talk a little bit about the ocean and the atmosphere, how they differ, and I think how thermodynamics and dynamics are intertwined. And how it's and in dynamics, both waves and turbulence play a role. So my particular personal interests of late have been what makes the ocean overturn, what makes it go round, and what is the role of large-scale turbulence in the ocean and atmosphere. And by turbulence, unfortunately, to some people has a connotation of being a very small-scale phenomena, centimetres or so on, but that's all wrong. I mean, turbulence, almost by definition, it has a range of scales, and the scales which I'm going to be talking about are scales of hundreds of kilometres, possibly, large-scale turbulence, macro turbulence, if you will. I'll talk a little bit about why the atmosphere is a heat engine and the role of waves and turbulence in that, and then talk a little bit about the ocean, and we will see that that is really not a heat engine in any meaningful way. And we'll talk about the role of waves and turbulence in that, and along the way I hope you'll learn some meteorology and oceanography. So you know, I guess first, why bother? Let's just compute the damn thing. And this is perhaps a little bit of a silly example, but it does make the point. The Reynolds number in the atmosphere is of the order of 10 to the 12th. That's equivalent to having a viscous scale of about 1 millimeter. And you can actually calculate, therefore, the number of degrees of freedom in that system, in the Earth's atmosphere, for example, with this Reynolds number or with this viscous scale. It actually scales like the Reynolds number to the 9/4th power, and that gives you 10 to the 27th. So really, in some sense, asking an atmospheric dynamicist why it doesn't compute it is like asking any physicist, well, why don't you just solve the Schrödinger equation for this solid that you have? I mean, you've got more degrees of freedom here than you have Avogadro's number. So it's obviously impossible. A little bit more sensibly, perhaps, the large eddies in the atmosphere, the weather scale is about 1,000 kilometres in the atmosphere, 100 or so kilometres in the ocean. To resolve ocean eddies globally, you need about this number of grid points, 1,000 by 1,000 by 100. So even if you have your own personal supercomputer, which I gather people do around here, it would be marginal at best to do that, and impossible on a routine basis. Of course, atmosphere, these large eddies in the atmosphere are well resolved, so it's a bit of a less, we can compute them, but of course you can invert that question and say, well, if you can compute them, why can't you understand them, for heaven's sake? So there's even less of an excuse for our lack of understanding. So I guess this emphasizes to me the need to understand as well as to simulate. They kind of go hand in hand. So here's the lower atmosphere overturning circulation, troposphere, basically. Troposphere is a little bit like a heat engine in the sense that this is heated where it is hot and cooled where it is cold. So it's heated here. This is actually the overturning circulation, and it rises and there's a circulation produced by that differential heating. That differential heating, the heating occurs below the level of the cooling. And that turns out to be very important. The heating occurs at a higher pressure. That's largely because the atmosphere is opaque, is transparent to solar radiation. So all the solar radiation goes straight through the atmosphere and heats up the ground, and then the ground heats up the atmosphere. The cooling occurs higher in the atmosphere at a lower pressure. So there's something of a heat engine effect here. And so this nearly adiabatic transfer of heat polewards in the circulation, and Hadley envisioned that there was one big overturning cell, which is true in a sense, but not in another sense. The heating creates potential energy, which is converted to kinetic energy in the atmosphere. That kinetic energy is lost to the system. Now, it's true that actually kinetic energy dissipation is returned as heat to the system, but you actually can't do any work with that heat. Otherwise, you could create a perpetual motion machine and violate the second law. So but the atmosphere is not just a thermodynamic place, it's a very dynamical place. So here's our globe, and we're heating here, and a ring of air is moving polewards. Okay. That ring of air is moving towards the axis of rotation. If it conserves its angular momentum, it must spin much faster than it did before. So here's another picture of that. The warm air rises, moves polewards, conserves its angular momentum, and then descends. Is that all there is to it? Let's look at a simulation. On the top, we have an axisymmetric model, i.e., we don't allow any variations with longitude. And the solid line is, just look at this solid line here. This is, in fact, the velocity produced by the model compared to the angular momentum conserving solution, which is the dashed line. And for a range of latitudes, this is the equator, it does, in fact, conserve angular momentum. The real atmosphere, or a real 3D model, does not conserve its angular momentum, because this flow here, as it moves polewards, would have a very, very large velocity, a very large shear, and that shear would be hydrodynamically unstable. And that hydrodynamic instability causes the flow to break down. It creates eddies. Those eddies are our weather. This is the overturning circulation in our axisymmetric model. It's this single cell which Hadley envisioned in 1735 in a rather quaintly written paper, I thought. This is how the real atmosphere or a real model works. It rises and falls, and it also rises at high latitudes and sinks in the subtropics. That's known as a Ferrel cell, after Ferrel, who was an American meteorologist in the 19th century. And actually, Ferrel's papers are worth reading for those dynamicists in the audience who are interested in a little bit of history, because they are almost some of the first modern papers in geophysical fluid dynamics. They've got a very modern flavor to them. So why does this cell go around the wrong way? I mean, the warm air is sinking, it seems. The middle latitude cell is overturning in the wrong direction, and that's because of a combination of waves and turbulence. So we start out with thermodynamics, we get dynamics, we get turbulence, but we also have waves. And it's kind of a profound consequence of Vosby waves, which are the waves that you have in the atmosphere, and 2D turbulence. The waves and turbulence almost inevitably coexist in the atmosphere. Because in two dimensions, energy is cascaded to large scales, not small scales. And arguably, I think that's one of the most important discoveries in fluid dynamics in the second half of the 20th century, that energy goes to large scales, not to small scales. But the larger the scale, the more Rossby waves dominate. And so at the large scales, the turbulence breaks up into waves. Here's a picture of the upscale, the energy spectrum in a simulation of two-dimensional turbulence. You force at small scales, it's the energy spectrum as a function of wave number. You force at small scales, the energy is transferred to large scales, you get this classical Kolmogorov spectrum, but it's going the wrong way. It's going to large scales. And energy is dissipated at large scales in the atmosphere, not at small scales. But here's a few, I'm going to show a few equations, but I'll try and talk you through them, and if you just listen to the words, and the experts can look at the equations. Dispersion relationship for Rossby waves has this form here. Beta is a constant divided by the wave number. So it means for large scales, the frequency is fast. It's one of the weird things about Rossby waves. They're the kind of the opposite of sound waves. The large scales oscillate most rapidly. Turbulence is kind of the opposite. The small scales oscillate most rapidly, so that there's some crossover wave number. What this means, the upshot of this is that for large scales, the atmosphere is dominated by Rossby waves. For smaller scales, smaller, relatively speaking, still hundreds of kilometers, it's dominated by turbulence. But these Rossby waves are inevitably important. Now, the other key thing about Rossby waves is that they transport momentum, and there was a little mechanical demonstration here I was going to use, but it's disappeared. But is it gone away? Anyway, never mind. But a rather clever thing that Rossby waves do is that they transport momentum in a particular direction. In particular, if you create Rossby, if imagine this is our globe and we're stirring here, the stirring is of course the turbulence in the atmosphere. We create Rossby waves. Rossby waves propagate away from the region of stirring. Momentum actually goes in the opposite direction of the group velocity of Rossby waves. So momentum will actually converge in this region of stirring. So if we are sitting on a rotating globe and we introduce a little propeller in mid-latitudes to create turbulence, that will create Rossby waves, and it will cause momentum to converge in the region of stirring, and it will give us our westerly winds. And here are a few equations just for the experts, really, to demonstrate this. This is my most equation-full slide. But just to lead you through it very briefly, this is the dispersion relationship for Rossby waves. This is their group velocity. It has this particular form. But the associated momentum flux associated with Rossby waves has this form, which is almost the same form as the group velocity. This product of the X wave number and the Y wave number in both. Now, if you're stirring a fluid, the waves must propagate away from your region of stirring. The group velocity must be directed away from the region of stirring. That's basically it's a radiation condition in wave dynamics. You would violate causality if it were directed the other way. So you know which direction the group velocity goes in by this simple argument, and that tells you what the associated and momentum flux is. So momentum is converging then in the region of the stirring. And I think the realization of this was perhaps one of the greatest advances in meteorology. This rather simple argument took a lot of time for people to understand. And so a simple consequence of that is that momentum may be transported up gradient, because it's not dependent upon the gradient of the velocity. It's dependent upon where the stirring is. So turbulent diffusion, concept which goes back to Ludwig Prandtl, simply does not happen. it ain't right. And before, we've known that it's not right, and for a long time people called it negative viscosity, because they, as a, and perhaps we shouldn't be surprised, because there are pressure forces, so momentum is not diffused, and we might think that we can diffuse other quantities like potential vorticity, but that's a story for another day. So, and here's just a numerical experiment, actually, where I've stirred here on a, this is latitude. I just introduce a propeller into my fluid here, and lo and behold, we create this westerly flow. And a consequence of that is that we also get these idealized bow-shaped eddies in the atmosphere. And actually, if you look at weather maps never look as good as they should. One often wonders why the atmosphere doesn't resemble theory better. But a consequence of this is simply that the eddies in the atmosphere and the ocean can be shaped by this bow shape, and you get this conversion, convergence of momentum in the middle of the domain. So, and you also get, because of this convergence of momentum, that is what makes the overturning circulation of the atmosphere go round, as it were, in the wrong way. It causes the hot air to sink and the cold air to rise, or it seems that way anyway. Because in the upper atmosphere, this convergence of momentum is actually balanced by the Coriolis force on the meridional flow. So you get a balance between this momentum convergence in the waves and the turbulence and the Coriolis force, and that causes the atmosphere to go around this way, and that's the cause of this feral cell. So, you know, so our thermodynamics is creating our basic flow. Our basic flow is unstable. That creates turbulence. Associated with the turbulence are Rossby waves, and Rossby waves have this rather unusual property of momentum convergence, and they'll cause momentum convergence, and that causes the part of the atmosphere to go around the wrong way. I guess it's the right way. But okay. The feral cell must still transport heat polewards. We'll come back to that. Let's talk a little bit about how the ocean is different. The ocean is heated at the equator, cooled at the pole. So is that a heat engine? We also expect the ocean to be baroclinic and unstable. The eddies in the ocean have about 10 times as much kinetic energy as the mean flow, which is a lot more, that ratio is much bigger than it is in the atmosphere. The eddies are more energetic in the ocean. But the eddies are small in the ocean. The eddies are much, much smaller than the ocean basin, so one wonders whether eddies are important. And lots of little, small, energetic eddies. And where do Rossby waves fit in? So, here's the thing about the ocean, how we might drive the ocean. Imagine this is a cross-section of the ocean. Here's the pole, here's the equator. Here's the ocean floor. We are, most of the heating occurs at the surface. So we're warming the ocean here near the equator. We're cooling it here near the pole. So we might imagine, after all, ain't it natural, that this cold air sinks, moves equatorwards, rises again, and we get this overturning circulation. This thermally driven overturning circulation. Often called the thermohaline circulation. Because salt has a bit of a role in there. And that's what we tend to think. Except if you go to a meeting or something like this, and you talk about this, and somebody will say, well, what about Sandstrom's theorem? And so Sandstrom was a student of Bjerknes, for the meteorologists. Bjerknes was one of the Willem Bjerknes was one of the grand old men of meteorology. Set at the Bergen School, and famous school of meteorology. Sandstrom in 1908 proposed the quote-unquote theorem. So all in one go is ignored, deified, and misunderstood. And some people say that the measure of somebody's stature in the field is how long they can set the field back for. So I don't know whether he set the field back, but he caused confusion. Seems to show that under certain circumstances, a deep ocean circulation cannot exist. But there was much hand-waving in his paper, and so people say, oh, it's not right. So let's revisit his theorem with a little bit more rigor. And here's the physical content. Here's almost a picture from his paper. And you heat, if this is actually the vertical, in the vertical, if you heat something, the warm air rises, and if you have some cooling above the level of the heating, you can imagine that you could get a nice, realizable, steady circulation in the flow. But if you cool below the level of the heating, it's hard to imagine a pathway that takes this cold air from the region of cooling to the region of heating. So it's hard to imagine that, but that's not really good enough. So let's... more equations, but not difficult equations. So here, let's make this... These are just the equations of motion of a fluid. Velocity. This is the Navier-Stokes equation for velocity. This is the temperature equation. Oceanographers like to use the symbol B for temperature. It's because B stands for buoyancy. That's all. So here's our temperature equation, here's our mass conservation equation. After some algebra, we derive a kinetic energy equation from this, and just look at the right-hand side. Pretend that the left-hand side is zero, that we're in a steady state. WB equals epsilon is a kinetic energy equation. Epsilon is the dissipation of kinetic energy. WB is the creation of kinetic energy. When warm air rises and cold air sinks, you're converting potential energy to kinetic energy. So that will be the balance in the kinetic energy equation. Balance in the potential energy equation, you create your potential energy, and this is followed in a few lines of algebra from this equation. You have Z, or Z. I'm English and I live in America and I'm visiting Canada. Z? Okay, Z. So Z times the heating is equal to this conversion term. So you put these two equations together and you have Z times the heating, Q dot, is equal to minus epsilon. Epsilon is kinetic energy dissipation, so this is less than zero. No, there can be no arguments about this derivation. It's a problem in textbooks now. So the heating must occur below the cooling in order to sustain a dissipative circulation. So if you are dissipating, if there's any turbulence at all in your system, the heating must occur because the correlation between the heating and Z must be negative. So the heating has to occur at a lower level, otherwise you cannot have turbulence. A corollary by Paparelli and Young is that if the heating is at the surface and occurs by the imposition of a surface boundary condition, then you can actually put a bound on the kinetic energy dissipation, and it's bounded by the molecular diffusivity and the temperature difference between the top and the bottom of the ocean. And this is a molecular diffusivity. So for small molecular diffusivity, the energy dissipation is correspondingly small. And if you do the arithmetic and put in the numbers, you find out this gives you a energy dissipation in the ocean of one hairdryer per cubic kilometer. 1 kilowatt, which is actually much smaller than is observed. So something else is going on. And what else is going on is that, in fact, there's another term on the right-hand side of the momentum equation, which is wind. You see, if this were the only thing going on, what would happen would be that the entire ocean circulation would be confined to a very thin layer at the ocean surface, and you wouldn't have any deep circulation at all. But there is a deep circulation. We know that. We observe it and we model it. Both of these figures are from models in which data has been assimilated, and there is a deep circulation. So deep circulation relies upon mechanical forcing, and that there is wind, and the wind provides actually a mechanism, conveyor belt if you will, for deep circulation. The wind also creates turbulence, can create turbulence. It creates gravity waves which propagate through the ocean and break, and hence it can provide a small-scale diffusivity in the ocean, which can also diffuse heat around. But you need that wind. So in a sense, all of the heating and cooling of the ocean are occurring at the same level. So we really shouldn't think of the ocean as being like a Carnot cycle or anything like that, because it ain't. And how it actually works, it turns out that the Antarctic circumpolar cones is a key feature of the ocean. And that's something I've been working on of late. And the Antarctic circumpolar cones is a little bit like the atmosphere in that the flow is re-entrance. It goes all the way around. It connects. Elsewhere, the ocean is in basins, of course. So being modelers, we simplify that enormously. So imagine this is our ocean, say, on the left. And so we have walls on one side, and we have a channel at the south. We find when we do a simulation that there is a overturning circulation. So that seems to be in violation of Samson's theorem, which is a perfectly rigorous theorem, except that we have wind. And the wind does an amazing... The wind actually creates a deep circulation, amazingly enough. And here I will do a schematic of the southern hemisphere. There's the pole, here's the equator. This is going up. The wind, it turns out, is such that it moves water polewards across the Antarctic circumpolar cones, which is this region right here. It moves the ocean polewards there. This water takes up the temperature of the surface. So when this water enters this region here, this water is actually the coldest water available in this region here. And in the basin it then sinks. And it sinks either to the bottom of the ocean or in this region to some region of topography, and then it must return by mass conservation. And without that wind driving, you won't have any of this deep overturning circulation. And in fact, here's a schematic of the global ocean circulation. That this entire deep global ocean circulation is at least in good part driven by the fact that there are winds of a certain sign in the Antarctic circumpolar cones region. So they are pushing water polewards here, and that water has to return. And both theoretical ideas and numerical simulations suggest that that is at least in part what drives the deep circulation of the ocean, the quote-unquote thermohaline circulation of the ocean. There is another part which is also buoyancy-driven in the North Atlantic. So, of course, the ocean itself is turbulent. I mean, we set up this flow, just as we do in the atmosphere, and then just when we think we've understood, you know, just then when we thought it was safe to go back in the water, we find that it in fact is full of eddies. So this large-scale circulation of the ocean breaks up into small-scale, smallish-scale turbulence on the scale of tens of hundreds of kilometers. And it turns out that, in fact, that the eddies make a large difference to the ocean's stratification. That the here, this is a numerical simulation of depth and latitude. The simulation on the left does not allow turbulence to form. Simulation on the right does allow turbulence to form. So on the left we have this overturning circulation, rather like my schematic model earlier. I increase the resolution of my model such that the hydrodynamic instability that gives rise to these eddies is allowed to operate, and gosh, that makes an enormous difference to the stratification of the ocean. So my ocean then is some combination of this large-scale circulation which I talked about plus the eddies. And understanding that is engaging my gray cells at the moment. So, as I say, these isotherms slump. Just another sort of a technicality, but not really a technicality. This is what the overturning circulation looked like in the model. The red lines are lines of constant temperature, constant buoyancy. Seems like the circulation crosses these lines. If the velocity is crossing lines of constant temperature, it means that there are some diabatic effects, because temperature is conserved on a fluid parcel unless something tells it not to be conserved. But here it seems like it's crossing it. But that can't be right, because there's nothing in my model in the deep ocean is adiabatic. So what is wrong there? What is wrong here is my diagnostic of the overturning circulation. This is just a zonally averaged overturning circulation. And meteorologists and oceanographers are fond of a somewhat simple transformation which has a grand name of transformed Eulerian mean. It just says that if you're transporting something like H, which is a thickness of a fluid layer, the total transport is composed of a mean term, V bar H bar, plus an eddy term, V prime H prime. Let's define a new velocity, V star, which is the sum of these two divided by H bar. Call that the residual velocity. Transform the equations to this residual velocity. Because this residual velocity is actually a more proper description of how the ocean is transporting things like temperature. And then if we do that, let me skip over that, we find out that, in fact, this was our Eulerian, as we like to call it, circulation. And this is our residual circulation after we've done this transformation. And in fact, the residual circulation is, in fact, almost parallel to the isopycnals. So a lot of theory now is actually involved in using these so-called transformed Eulerian mean equations. Because one nice thing turns out that when you put the momentum equation into these transformed variables, a miracle occurs. Because on the right-hand side, it turns out that the eddy fluxes are the eddy fluxes of this quantity called potential vorticity, which is a wonderful quantity with all sorts of nice properties, and which might in fact be diffused. And we can make a theory from potential vorticity. And I was going to say that I did make a theory of potential vorticity, and it predicted that something, the depth of my stratification went like the wind stress to the 2/5 power, and I thought I finally got it right and did the simulations, and it didn't work. So anyway, work in progress. You know, we're trying to understand this turbulence. We think we've got a framework to understand this turbulence, but it's not working yet. So back to the atmosphere anyway. So what's going on in the atmosphere? We said, here's this picture of the atmosphere. And we've got this three-celled structure of the atmosphere. Circulation is going around like this, and then it's going around like this, and then around like this. So we've got this three-celled structure in the atmosphere. We said that it was rising here and sinking here, and we could explain that by the convergence of momentum by Rossby waves, and we can. That's fine. That's a sort of a approximate reason for that circulation. But we've still got to transport heat from here to here, from down here to up here. So if we put the atmosphere into these transformed coordinates, it turns out that the atmosphere then takes a single-celled form with air rising at the equator and sinking at high latitudes. So the residual circulation is direct, and there's a single cell of residual circulation. So that's, in a sense, why I said that in my abstract, Hadley was right after all, quote-unquote right. He thought that the circulation really was like this. Unless he was cleverer than we think, he didn't anticipate this transformed Eulerian mean by 250 years. But nonetheless, there's something, you see, when you do transform to this transformed Eulerian mean, the thermodynamic equation takes a rather simple form. And it appears, you see, all the eddies get put into the momentum equation. So the residual circulation, this is the thermodynamic equation, remember B is the temperature, appears not to have the eddies in there. So this circulation, this is, well, the top one is the Eulerian mean circulation. So if you just do a naive zonal average, you get this one. But then if you do this clever averaging, you get a single cell circulation. So just finally, and talk for just a few minutes about the stratosphere. And these are plots of the overturning circulation in the stratosphere. The stratosphere is different again. So minus 90 is the South Pole, plus 90 is the North Pole. July, September, January of some particular year, but just focus on the middle one first, and this is the residual circulation in the stratosphere. And it's called the Brewer-Dobson circulation. And I hadn't realized before coming here this week that Brewer is a alumni, or whatever you want to call it, of former faculty member of Toronto. So, and he was looking at observations of water vapor. Dobson was looking at, independently, observations of ozone. Both of them inferred a circulation somewhat like this one. These are from much more modern observations. I should say another difference between the ocean and the atmosphere, slightly off to the point, in a single day, more or less, we take more observations of the atmosphere than we've ever had in the history of oceanography. I mean, there are thousands of measurements. And that may be a slight exaggeration, but, you know, 2 days' measurements will give you... that's not always good, actually, sort of as a personal aside, because it means that, you know, a theoretician... composite something, and some observer will come along and say, no, that's not right. and you'll be back down into your little cubbyhole. And whereas the oceanographers can come up with some nice theory, and the observers can't say that it's wrong. And that's sometimes a good thing, because your theory is sometimes wrong the first time, and you need a little bit of time to develop it and get it right. But if you have no, there's always somebody saying, you're wrong, it's not good. So, so the stratus, so actually that's partly why a lot of the ideas, some of the theoretical ideas in meteorology have come from stratospheric dynamicists. So in particular this, this transformed Eulerian mean came from people thinking about the stratosphere. So where was I? So air is rising here and sinking here. So this is our Brewer-Dobson circulation. This is the residual circulation in the stratosphere. What's interesting is that, in fact, if you look in summer, the air is sinking over the summer pole in both hemispheres. And that is actually the region where the heating is strongest in the summer. You've got 24 hours of daylight. You're actually heating here. But even the residual circulation is sinking here. So, in a sense, the stratosphere is a mechanically driven natural refrigerator in summer. And how it's driven is, again, by these ubiquitous infernal Rossby waves. And the Rossby waves, I should have had a picture of Rossby waves propagating, but Rossby waves are propagating in the generated in the troposphere by this turbulence that we talked about. A great generator of waves. The Rossby waves don't just propagate meridionally, they propagate vertically. And in the stratosphere, then, in this transformed coordinates, we find that there is a balance between the meridional circulation and the wave drag. And the wave drag occurs because the Rossby waves propagate upwards, and their amplitude gets bigger. They go into a region of lower density, and they break. They overturn. And the analogy is so good with waves coming into a beach and breaking that region of the stratosphere has become known as the surf zone, where waves break. It's really an entropy cascade region, if you're into 2D turbulence. But then you have a balance between the meridional circulation and the wave drag, which is this eddy flux of potential vorticity, and it has a the waves break and deposit westward momentum in the stratosphere. So this generates this mechanically driven overturning circulation in the stratosphere. And perhaps if one were to, and here's just a schematic I put together, showing kind of the overturning circulation in the atmosphere. And in the atmosphere, this overturning circulation is nearly all of this residual flow and not of the Eulerian flow, except in the low-latitude troposphere where the Hadley-Cell really is air rising and sinking. And if you do a conventional average, it actually gives you a good picture of where the air parcels are going, because the low-latitude troposphere is pretty zonally symmetric. But here's our surf zone. Here we have these Rossby waves breaking. Of course, the surf zone is much stronger in winter, partly because the troposphere is generating Rossby waves like crazy in winter. So they propagate. There's much more upwards propagation of Rossby waves, and they break in the surf zone, generating this Brewer-Dobson circulation. And just as a final aside, really high up in the stratosphere, beyond the stratosphere, gravity waves will break and actually give you a pole-to-pole circulation. Again, it's mechanically driven by this wave breaking. So let me just conclude by saying circulation of the atmosphere and ocean are an intertwining, I think, of thermodynamics and dynamics. And the dynamics themselves are an intertwining of waves and turbulence. So, and you can't get rid of any of them. It makes it a nice subject in a way. I mean, you've got a bit of everything. The atmosphere is in part a heat engine. In a classical way. But not the ocean. The ocean would be if seawater were transparent to solar radiation. But you see, all the solar radiation goes all the way through the atmosphere and it gets absorbed at the ground. But the ocean is virtually impervious to many forms of electromagnetic radiation. That's why submarines find it hard to communicate in the ocean. And so nearly all the heating that occurs and the cooling in the ocean occurs at the top. So we really require wind to produce both the wind-driven circulation, which I haven't talked about very much, and the deep circulation. That wind provides both a direct means to drive the circulation, and it also provides eddy diffusivities, which enable small-scale turbulence to exist. So the atmosphere is in part also mechanically driven, as we've discovered. It's this mechanical wave break. It's the breaking of Rossby waves and the transfer of momentum in Rossby waves, which gives rise to the fact that we have westerly winds at the surface in the atmosphere. And also, that wave breaking is producing really the large part of the circulation in the middle and the upper atmosphere. So that's the picture I'm trying to paint. I think we're not obviously at the end of our understanding. And we're not even, Churchill might have said, we're not even at the beginning of the end of our understanding. But I think we're sort of at the end of the beginning because we kind of have a framework now for understanding how all these things fit together, how they will fit together, and whether we can come up with any kind of semi-analytic theory is open to question. I mean, there's been a lot of progress. There's been very little progress in turbulence itself, in the sort of the fundamental theory and ideas of turbulence, and ideas come along on sort of a decadal time scale. But I think perhaps we can understand, hopefully we don't need to understand turbulence completely to have a good understanding of the atmosphere and ocean, although it certainly would help. But I'll stop there. Thanks.
Started that a lot of these topics are covered in your upcoming book. But I put a plug in for it, kind of like John Stewart or something. Jeff has a book coming out in about 9 months or so, Cambridge University Press. It's called Atmosphere and Ocean Fluid Dynamics, right? We've used it in some of our courses here. It's a nice book. It should be very instructive. One other point. Jeff has been here all week, so it's been a very nice visit for the atmospheric physics group. So let's take some questions.
Going back to your previous slide, can you point out the regions where the Rossby, where the momentum is converging, and describe in just a little more detail how that drives?
Yeah, okay. I mean, perhaps momentum is converging in this region. Well, you can maybe slightly see the shaded regions are regions of wave breaking. What is happening, essentially, most of it, the momentum convergence is actually occurring in the troposphere. I mean, most things happen in the troposphere. So what is happening is that if we didn't have any eddies at all, the flow air would rise here, would move polewards, sink, and come back again. As it moves polewards, it generates an enormous shear. That shear is unstable. It breaks up into basically weather. Then that generates Rossby waves, because we're on a rotating planet, and Rossby waves are natural. Those Rossby waves will propagate away from the region and break. But Rossby waves transport momentum. So there's a flux of momentum associated with Rossby waves, and there'll be a divergence of that flux where they break. So the Rossby waves have been generated here. They're propagating both northwards, southwards, and upwards. And so now the momentum convergence is occurring right here.
In the direction of the force is...
And then when it's converging, the direction of the force is eastward. Okay, so that's giving us our westerlies. But where they're breaking outside, then your direction of your force is the opposite, and so that's giving you flow going the other way. At the surface, there's got to be exactly the same amount of easterlies as westerlies. Because if there weren't, there'd be a net angular momentum exchange between the Earth, the solid Earth, and the atmosphere, and the atmosphere would spin up until that were satisfied. Interestingly enough, clocks are so accurate these days that you can look at the rotation speed of the Earth and find that it's not exactly constant. It varies by some tiny fraction of a second, but you can measure it, and you can correlate that with what's going on in the atmosphere. So there is an exchange of angular momentum between the solid Earth and the atmosphere, which causes the rotation rate of the Earth to vary ever so slightly.
Is there a dimensionless parameter that would characterize, you know, which situations you would get a signal hold to equal the circulation, like if you could slow down the Earth, would you get a signal cell, or if you...
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. There are non-dimensional parameters, indeed. They are related to things like the Rossby number. The Rossby number is a ratio of a velocity to the rotation rate of the Earth times a length, U over omega times L. So that's one of the most fundamental non-dimensional numbers, and if you're in a small Rossby number regime, which we are, then rotation is important, and you'd get Rossby waves, and so on and so forth. And if the Rossby number is small, the turbulence will tend to be two-dimensional rather than three-dimensional. But there's not just the Rossby number. There's a large number of other non-dimensional numbers, which tend to be large, like the Reynolds number is large and the Rayleigh number is large, which is a measure of the intensity of the thermal forcing.
So is a number like, can we know if the Earth spins at half the speed, you will have four
degrees? That's a difficult one. Half. Well, you see, the Rossby number in the atmosphere is about 0.1, which is small, but it's not that small. So if you were half, I think it would be similar to what it is now. If it were a quarter, I think we'd start to look different. Well, if it were faster, if the Earth were to spin a lot faster, then I think it would kind of become more two-dimensional and more like Jupiter. So if you look at Jupiter, you've seen pictures of Jupiter. It has multiple jets. And opinions differ about what causes the jets on Jupiter, but almost certainly they are related to the rotation and the differential rotation of the planet. So if the Earth were to spin a few times faster, we'd probably have multiple jets. Some people have argued that, in fact, the Earth is on a verge of being in a multiple jet regime. Sometimes, in fact, you do see multiple jets in the Earth's atmosphere. So, in fact, that's another story.
Yes,
that's right.
Transporting warm air and warm water towards Europe, I guess the reverse current.
Yeah, right.
Been diminishing, and as a result, Europe is expected to cool down over there.
Yeah.
No explanation was given, it was just sort of stated as something.
Well, I mean, my only knowledge of that study is reading it in the Globe and Mail this morning, so. Okay, here's, let me go back to, this picture. What one argument for the thermal, although I kind of concentrated on the wind, the fact that there's a wind-driven ocean circulation, a deep ocean circulation, part of the, especially the North Atlantic, may be thermally driven, with water sinking here and rising back like this. And a lot of simulations, numerical simulations of global warming, show this circulation becoming much weaker as the Earth gets warmer. And part of the reason for that is potentially that you are getting more precipitation at high latitudes. Precipitation is fresh water. The ocean is salty water, so that's less buoyancy, and that might weaken the overturning circulation. And various numerical models have given this. The complicating features are that a lot of the ocean is wind-driven also. We haven't seen a whole lot of changes in the winds. In fact, we haven't really seen large changes in the precipitation. So that this is occurring is, I would say, regarded as a little bit controversial by oceanographers, on the one hand. And secondly, even if it is occurring, its effects on the European climate are by no means clear. Some other studies in disciplinary journals have argued that, in fact, the effect of this on Europe's climate has been somewhat exaggerated. Or even in Nature sometimes. But I didn't say that. Yeah.
You did mention that the driving force was the south polar wind.
Yes, that's right.
I understand that wind, the Cataract wind, if I remember the word correctly, is very strong. Can you explain why this?
Well, I mean, the main winds which are driving the ACC are the winds, the east-west winds, the zonal winds, winds which would be into or out of the board here. And they are about twice as strong as the winds in the northern hemisphere, largely because there's nothing to stop them. There's much more ocean in the southern hemisphere, and in particular in the region of the ACC. In fact, do I have a picture of that? I can't remember which way I'm going. Okay, well, for example, look at this enormous region where there are, I mean, there are some mountains coming down from the Andes here, but you've got a large region of just ocean. So with the same, roughly speaking, you're going to get stronger winds in the southern hemisphere just because of the geography of the southern hemisphere. And so, I mean, it's interesting. If things happen to the southern ocean winds, then we also may get changes in thermohaline circulation in the northern hemisphere. But the degree to which that is the case, I mean, that's an open question, I guess, as to the precise balance between the wind driving in the southern ocean and the actual more thermal driving is a topic of debate in the literature. Ah, okay. Well, I think, in a sense, most IPCC models these days are actually using coupled ocean atmosphere models. And so, in principle, these effects should be in their models. The degree to which they are is less clear. I mean, for example, one large region of uncertainty is what we should use for an eddy diffusivity in the ocean. Now, we can't go down to the molecular scale, so we have to, even in using the Earth simulator, we have to have some parameterizations for the effects of small-scale turbulence producing diffusion of heat in the ocean. I guess the what values we should use is an open question. And the values which we think we should use seems to have been diminishing over the last decade, just as our knowledge has increased. And I should also say that a lot of the uncertainty in IPCC comes from another, yeah, I guess it's another turbulence problem, is how we treat clouds. Clouds and the ocean are the two biggest uncertainties in global warming. Understanding clouds is... and having good parameterizations for clouds is an area of enormous uncertainty at the moment. So